Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Welcome, listeners. Here's what we got put together tonight. The Alabama prison builder, Eli Gage, Joe Lee, and Rodney Moss from the Hunt family of incarceration, where they're going to build the new Jackson County Correctional Facility, licking their chops on a $200 million county prison with a 1,200-bed lockup capable of processing 1,000 prisoners a day, like the Los Angeles County facility they built during the Trump administration. Death Metal Night, featuring Crypta from Brazil, Epica from France, Ex-Hoarder from the Oakland Bay Area. And I'll be reading from Anarchism and the Black Revolution by Lorenzo Comboa Irving from Pluto Press. Then we have the Real News Network Rattling the Bars episode, Alabama Prison is on Strike. We'll listen to reporter Mike Cianato from The Guardian as he breaks down the conflicts existing in Alabama and the state of the Alabama prison system. The strike will continue indefinitely until there is a mass release of Alabama prisoners. John Stewart, who interviews a senator from Arkansas, a former queen of the debutante ball, Leslie Rutledge. Ms. Kelly Hayes from Movement Notes at truthout.org talks about identity politics with the author of Elite Capture, Ovathani Tylo from the Georgetown Philosophy Department, a Noam Chomsky dialogue from the Bush era. Then we finish with Daryl Lamont Jenkins from IdaVox podcast number 3, where the Antifa crew talk about the musical Hamilton, libertarians, class, Thomas Paine, and organizing against American Renaissance Conference at Montgomery Bell Park in Burns, Tennessee, this coming November.
And this last one talks about the moment we're living right now, where we're currently trying to rise from the ashes!
We'll be right back.
Social infrastructure issues, like aging facilities, insufficient funding, inadequate staffing, and an ever-changing political climate. Here's your host, Eli Gage.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 360 Justice Podcast. I'm your host, Eli Gage, and I'm joined by my co-host and friend, Joe Lee. Thanks for joining, Joe.
Thank you, Eli.
I'm also joined today with Rodney Moss, who is a senior vice president with the Hunt Companies, who happens to be the parent company of CGL. But I think you're probably, in my opinion, one of the foremost experts specifically in the criminal justice world in the country.
Glad to be here, Eli.
For our listeners, you're a trained engineer as well as a lawyer.
Yeah.
You can't show your man.
Anarchism and the Black Revolution by Lorenzo Gamboa Irving. How the capitalists use racism. The fate of the white working class has always been bound with the condition of black workers. Going as far back as the American colonial period when black labor was first imported into America, black slaves and indentured servants have been oppressed right along with whites of the lower classes. But when European indentured servants joined with black rebels against their lot in the late 1600s, the property class decided to free them by giving them a special status as whites and thus stake in the system of oppression. Material incentives as well as newly elevated social status to ensure these lower classes allegiance. The invention of white race and racial slavery of the Africans went hand in glove and is how the upper classes maintained order during the period of slavery. Even poor whites had aspirations of doing better since their social mobility was ensured by the new system. This social mobility, however, was on the backs of the African slaves who were super exploited. But the die had been cast in the dual-tier form of labor whose exploitation trapped white labor. When they sought to organize unions or for higher wages in the North or South, white laborers were slapped down by the rich and used enslaved black labor as their primary mode of production. The so-called free labor of the white worker did not stand a chance. Although capitalists used the system of white skin privilege to great effect to divide the working class, the truth is that capitalists only favored white workers to use them against their own interests, not because there was true white class unity. The capitalists didn't want white labor united with blacks against their rule and the system of exploitation of labor. The invention of the white race was a scam to facilitate this exploitation while workers were brought off to allow their own wage slavery and the African super exploitation. They struck a deal with the devil, which hampered all efforts at class unity for the last four centuries. The continual subjugation of masses depends on competition and internal disunity. As long as discrimination exists and racial or ethnic minorities are oppressed, the entire working class is oppressed and weakened. This is so because the capitalist class is able to use racism to drive down the wages of individual segments of the working class by inciting racial antagonism and forcing a fight for jobs and services. The division is a development that ultimately undercuts the living standards of all workers. Moreover, by pitting whites against blacks and other oppressed nationalities, the capitalist class is able to prevent workers from uniting against their common class enemy. As long as the workers are fighting each other, capitalist class rule is secure. If an effective resistance is to be mounted against the current racist offensive of the capitalist class, The utmost solidarity between workers of all races is essential, and the way to defeat the capitalist strategy is for white workers to defend the democratic rights won by blacks and others oppressed people after decades of hard struggle, and to fight to dismantle the system of white skin privilege. White workers should support and adopt concrete demands of the black movement and should work to abolish the white identity entirely. The white workers should strive for multicultural unity and should work with black activists to build an anti-racist movement to challenge white supremacy. However, it is only important to recognize the right of the black movement to take an independent road in its own interest. That's what self-determination means.
Welcome to this edition of Rattling Bars. I'm Master Music Co-host Eddie Conway. Eddie Conway has been doing good. Eddie Conway's health has been improving. And hopefully at some point in time, Eddie Conway will make an cameo appearance, program that he started, and the network that he loved. Alabama prison system is on strike. I'm going to list a few things that encapsulate why they would be on strike. The failure of the Alabama correction system to protect inmates from violence and sexual abuse, the failure to protect them from excessive force by staff, and the failure to provide safe conditions of confinement, alleging the violation of the Eighth Amendment right. This would be some of the issues that anyone would say that the entire prison system is on strike about, and that these would be the things that they would be alleging. What I just listed is what the Department of Justice is alleging in a suit they filed against the Alabama Correction Institution in 2020. Here to talk about what's going on in the heart of the South and the prison industrial complex in the heart of the South is Mike Saronato. Michael, introduce yourself to the Rattling the Bars viewers, and you're no stranger to it, but go ahead and introduce yourself again, please.
Well, my name is Michael Saronato. I'm a reporter for the Guardian and the Real News Network. I cover mostly labor issues, but I cover, you know, prison labor issues as well, and I reside in Gainesville, Florida.
Mike, let's just go right into the issue. Update on the prison strike, statewide prison strike, mind you, in the state of Alabama.
So the strike started yesterday, and the Alabama Department of Corrections, you know, admitted all major prisons have experienced varying degrees of workers on strike. So the jobs that are on strike are prisoners who have to work in food prep and the kitchen services and the maintenance and cleaning services. And you know, you mentioned a couple of the issues behind the strike. The Department of Justice a few years ago ruled that the Alabama prison system is violating the Constitution, violating human rights because of the poor conditions. And just a couple of years ago, you know, they filed a lawsuit because the state of Alabama hasn't corrected or fixed anything, and they still haven't. It's, you know, 4 years since that issue was first brought up by the Department of Justice, and the only thing that Alabama has done is started to construct new prisons, but those won't even be open till for another 3 or 4 years. So I think one of the biggest issues behind the strikes is that paroles just aren't being granted at all. The couple of the organizations behind this strike have noted that 97% of parolees have been denied parole. So it seems that parole boards are just outright denying parole for those in prison for, you know, cases that, you know, shouldn't be, you know, denied at all. And that comes into play. Alabama has some really harsh sentencing laws. You know, they have like a 30-year minimum for juvenile offenders. You know, people are getting life sentences for nonviolent crimes. You know, there's a lot of issues.
Right. And in that regard, right, they, one of the things that the supporters of the strikers are asking for is the repeal of the Habitual Felony Offender Act, which is contributing to what you just talked about as far as the creating a draconian and inhumane sentences that leads to the prison population being overcrowded. But let's talk about some of the things that the Justice Department found, and more importantly, this report, the Justice Department filed a suit. The court has already ruled that ain't nothing going to take place. Nothing is going to take place in regard to the suit 2024, where they'll have a trial on the issues. Now, mind you, we're talking about the Justice Department has cited these conditions that exist. Violence. Alabama had one of the most violent prison system in the country. I think they say like 30% of every 100,000 prisoners are killed in Alabama prisons. That means that everybody in the maximum medium security prison in Alabama, when they go in these systems, they expect some sort of violence to take place. The Justice Department cited in the women's prison, cited that 30% of the women in the medium and maximum security prisons are molested by the officers. Prisons are overcrowded. This is the Justice Department study that they came out and said this and sued in this regard. So why is it that we're at the stage right now where the prison population is forced to have a strike in order to get redress or get attention to the problem when it's already been noted? Why are we having this intransigent attitude from the state towards remedying these problems?
Yeah.
have Governor Kay Ivey and Alabama Republicans who are in power who are either have been dismissive of the issues within their prison systems. They've denied and disputed claims from the Department of Justice. And this goes back to, this was the Department of Justice under the Trump administration. That
exactly, exactly.
Out. So, and these are human rights violations. So there's really been no swift actions being taken to address these problems, these parole denials and these harsh sentencing laws, overcrowding's getting worse, and that fuels, you know, violence, and it's not just prisoner on prisoner. There's a video out today that was released of prison guards just assaulting a prisoner ridiculously. Just a warning, if you do go on social media and look for it or watching it, it's pretty brutal. And a prisoner was reported to have died in Alabama prison today. They were tied up and found assaulted. So you have a lot of these vast issues within the prison system, and it's just untenable, and they keep kicking the can down the road and saying it's going to be addressed in a few years, but these human rights violations are occurring now, and they're harming people now. And it's not just those in prison, it's people who are their families who are, you know, are concerned for the well-being and safety and want their family members to be released. They're placed in these areas where they're not seen by the majority of the population, and these small towns rely on these prisons economically for jobs. So there's economic incentives to maintain and grow the mass incarceration system in the U.S. because you have rural areas that have experienced declines in job loss, are dealing with economic issues and rural poverty. These prisons are always kind of sold and brought and idolized by local politicians in these areas and local governments and just the local communities. They're not seen as, you know, address the prisoners for the people they are and the impacts on them and their families and their communities. As just an economic engine, you know, for this mass incarceration system. And those new buildings are being built not only regards to the human rights violations, but because the current prisons are just, the infrastructure is so bad, you know, they can't renovate them, that it's not even possible. So they have to develop entirely new buildings. But in the meantime, this poor infrastructure, this inadequate infrastructure that...
Thank you.
overcrowding is being used, and admitting prisoners in Alabama right now are subjected to that, are having being forced in that environment under really bad conditions. You know, we've seen it over the years, every summer, you know, the lack of air conditioning, the lack of inadequate edible food. I've heard that from every time I've spoken with someone who's done time in Alabama. That's a huge, huge issue. You know, Alabama, it relies on prison labor to keep these prison services running.
Tonight.
ballot initiatives are focusing on state constitutions. So our constitution has that exception to slavery. Slavery is abolished except for those in prison. You know, there's local movements in a lot of states right now. Three have already removed this exception clause. Rhode Island, Utah, and I can't remember, is one of these states that in November voters will decide on whether to keep or get rid of that clause. You know, the strike right now that's going on that has to do with those jobs. Workers are getting paid to work, you know, maintenance and kitchen and food service jobs that, you know, outside in the normal world, you'd be getting
minimum wage at least.
We're Krista from Brazil, and we're here to play some death metal for you all. Are you ready? Are you fucking ready, bucket? Now for a fast one. Starvation!
Oh, Why would the state of Arkansas step in to override parents, physicians, psychiatrists, endocrinologists who have developed guidelines? Why would you override those guidelines?
Well, I think it's important that all of those physicians, all of those experts, for every single one of them, there's an expert that says we don't need to allow children to be able to take those medications, that there are many instances
right.
where...
But you know that's not true. You know it's not for everyone there's one. There's these are the established...
Well, I don't know that that's not true. I don't know that...
Then why
you
would
know
you
that.
Why would you pass a law then if you don't know that that's true? Wouldn't you
Well,
have
I know that
so?
There are doctors and that we had plenty of people come and testify before our legislature mm-hmm. who said that you know, we have 98% of the young people who have gender dysphoria
right.
That they are able to move past that, and once they have the help that they need, no longer suffer from gender dysphoria. 98%
wow.
without that medical treatment.
That's an incredibly made-up figure.
Fire!
You're making it sound like a 9-year-old walks into a doctor's office and says, give me some testosterone. And the doctor goes, oh, thank God, because we're wanting to create an army of transgenders because we're crazy.
Harrison, Arkansas is the most racist town in the United States.
And we'll pride the race, brother! White pride, all white!
I want to stay after dark, man.
Honestly, dude, you have balls of steel. You could get hospitalized by some guys that want to beat your ass.
I've had several old men come by here, look out the window and tell me, says, you better go tell that nigger to get out of here and shit.
About 10 minutes, I'm going to be back. You better be fucking gone.
Okay, come back.
What that white man? We matter.
You're a white man.
Crazy.
You're a dumb ass
motherfucker.
You
dumb shit.
Are you a Marxist?
Communist.
Domestic terrorist.
Why don't you take it to Chicago or New York or
Colorado?
Real fucking job.
I'm Jesus. You guys out of town. That shit don't make shit here.
Hey, all lives matter, not just black.
You're Caucasian.
You're white.
You look like a white guy holding a black flag.
That's your sense. You're a white boy.
You're white, aren't you?
Oh, boy.
Because I'm tired of seeing
This right here is the biggest hoax there ever was.
It's just the next thing to act.
It is.
Yeah, black lives do matter, but what about ours, man?
Apparently black people's lives matter more than us.
Apparently.
How's your day going? Walmart, they put out this statement.
To leave. Exactly what I'm saying is exactly what they would ask.
Now's the time to summon the goddess of destruction, and this one goes to all the women here in the crowd.
Johnny!
Movement Memos, a truth out podcast about solidarity, organizing,
and the work of making change. I'm your host, writer and organizer, Kelly Hayes. Today, we are talking about identity politics, social media, and navigating difference within our movement. We will be hearing from Olufemi Taiwo, a professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, and author of the book Elite Capture, How the Powerful Took Over Identity Phenomena Known as Elite Capture. We are going to get into what that means in a moment, but first, I wanted to talk a bit about the CIA's recent unveiling of a statue of Harriet Tubman outside their headquarters in suburban Virginia, because there are some connections to be made here. In statements to the press, the CIA emphasized the covert nature of Tubman's work on the Underground Railroad and highlighted her efforts behind enemy lines in support of the Union Army during the Civil War. The agency also took the opportunity to emphasize to the press that the CIA has made gains in diversity with a 3% increase in minority hiring over the last 2 years. We are not talking about a more colorful assortment of trained assassins doling out imperial violence abroad. Not everyone welcomed critiques of the disconnect between what Harriet Tubman's life and work were about and the death-making, anti-democratic, imperial violence of the CIA. On Twitter, for example, critics of the CIA's co-option of Tubman's legacy were lectured by some people that Tubman was, in fact, a spy, which made the honor fitting and appropriate. I saw some people note that Tubman's great-great-great-grandniece was in attendance and smiling. CIA Director William Burns told NBC News, "For all of us, this statue will not only remind us of Tubman's story, assume you are not someone who can be duped into believing that the CIA shares the values of Harriet Tubman. In fact, I have zero doubt that if Tubman were alive today, she would be working in opposition to the harms of law enforcement in some capacity or another. It is more likely that she would be breaking people out of prisons than working for a monstrous organization like the CIA. But what should we take away from this effort to co-opt a radical legacy and the discourse that emerges around that effort?"
There's a lot of stuff coming out recently from the CIA ads about having, you know, more intersectional spies, to local governments embracing the kind of aesthetic of radical politics, to the decades and decades of the sort of mangling of the political legacy of people like Martin Luther King Jr. Really bugs me, as I'm sure it bugs anybody who genuinely cares about these issues, unlike the CIA. But it's also, to me, something that really demonstrates the limits of a kind of criticism of a politics based on the kinds of co-optation that it faces. It's a really good place to start thinking about identity politics in particular, because the term identity politics comes from the Combahee River Collective, which was a group of queer Black women socialists that met in Boston and who named themselves after a raid done on the Confederacy by Harriet Tubman. The 19th century, Harriet Tubman is fucking up the Confederacy with the help of her comrades, Black soldiers, and freeing people from slavery. I'm sure she would be annoyed that the forces of global white supremacy and regime change and et cetera, are claiming what she did 100 and some odd years later. I don't think she would have done a single thing differently. I don't think that any of us now in 2022 should be doing anything differently just because people on the right or the center right or the center left bin or lie about the things that we do. We have to have our own perspective on what objectives are worth it, what political frameworks are worth it, and we just have to realize that perfectly delineating good politics from bad politics isn't a power that good politics has, either at the level of actions or at the level of ideas. Like, people will just be able to lie and cheapen things and distort and co-opt and distract. And that is just what we're in for as people involved in politics. One thing I've been really trying to hold on to is the analysis of this as a kind of sign of ideological weakness by the people that we oppose, as opposed to just a problem. Obviously, it is a problem that, you know, people might get confused and think that what Harriet Tubman stands for has anything to do with what the CIA stands for. Anyone does on the left. But it wasn't too long ago the powers that be were draping themselves in the imagery of supervillains, right? It wasn't too long ago that in polite company, you could say, I'm for apartheid, I'm for segregation, so on and so forth. We think of that as ancient history. It's not. There are people older than the end of that era. So the fact that the powers that be are trying to drape themselves in the imagery of Harriet Tubman, as opposed to the imagery of Confederates, the kind of Confederates that Harriet Tubman was shooting at, is indicative of victories that the left has had. And I don't want to at all overstate those kind of ideological victories. And of course, if the far right on the march across the globe in the U.S. and in Italy and in Brazil and in Hungary has their way, we might very soon be back to the era where the powers that be openly say we're for, in the way that they're starting to say now, we're for transphobia, we're for fighting against critical race theory. But in the meantime, I think it's worth acknowledging the fact that they're having to lie about these things is a demonstration of a kind of weakness on their part.
Economic power was diffusing in U.S. domains. It was diffusing into three major power centers, German-led Europe, Japan and its region, and the United States and its region. The United States is still the biggest, you know, but not very much anymore. And in fact, the Reaganite policies severely harmed the American economy, and it's going to, those costs have not yet come due, but they're serious. The Vietnam War harmed the American economy. It was very costly to the United States, very beneficial to the industrial rivals of the United States. And all of that stuff changed the structure of the world economy. That's a major part of the New World Order. Three major powers, the U.S., especially after Reagan, now deeply in debt and much weakened. That's part of the New World Order. What about the Russian... 5 minutes, yeah, I'm just about done. What about the disappearance of the Soviet Union? Well, by the mid-70s, it was pretty clear that the Russians were in bad trouble. In fact, their military expenditures started leveling off, exactly the opposite of what we were told at the time, but the CIA has now conceded it. And by a couple of years later, it's pretty clear that they're finished. And the effect of that is, there's several effects to that. One effect is rhetorical. Since 1917, every American intervention anywhere has been in defense against the Russians.
Thank you.
major economic powers, one major military power. That military power doesn't any longer have the economic base to carry off intervention, who keep the third world under control.
Gentlemen, our entire set was dedicated to Olaf from Crucified. May you rest in peace, my brother. We know you're here in the skies. Bless this weekend. Bless the people. One love, one compassion, one heart, one human.
If there's a diplomatic settlement, it's of no particular advantage to the United States. If there's a capitulation to force, it's of considerable advantage to the United States. If you can show that force is the crucial device for controlling the world, you're better off.
We'll be right back. crazy because Hamilton, everybody is just like, at least on the political side, is down in it because there's a lot of issues concerning the fact that you have all these black and brown characters playing slave owners. And you don't really get into the story about Hamilton, and his attitude towards slavery and things. I mean, that is important. But I think that basically when it comes to stuff like Hamilton, it's just like if it gets people through the door when it comes to stuff like that, then get them through the door. Just fill in the blanks. That's what we're here for.
George Washington, I'm going to say goodbye. That scene in the show, you know, which was written well before January 6th. It was just so relevant, you know, as we think about January 6th on the other side and George Washington, you know, telling Hamilton, we're going to teach the country how to say goodbye. Lots of things there that you could dive deeply into.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that we marry a lot of what had happened back then to what is going on now. And not in the way you would think, though.
Yeah.
Not in the way you would think. I mean, I always tell everybody, for example, that today's libertarians and today's ANCAPs are similar to the founding fathers. And that's not a prop.
I could see that.
Not a prop.
No, I could see that. I could see because if you're looking at the founding fathers and well, I could see that. I would say that at least libertarians in their heads, they would see themselves as founding fathers because, I mean, the founding fathers, I mean, when we talk about the American Revolution as I see it and as we learn about it in political science, like in my background, it's not really a revolution, right? It's an anti-colonial struggle. You have this class of rich men who don't want to pay taxes to, yes, an unnecessary middleman in the crown, and they revolt against that. But nowadays, when you look at these libertarians, in many ways, it's from what I've seen in studying libertarians or anarcho-capitalists. I don't like calling them ANCAPs because they're not anarchists. And, you know, there's that whole HBO drama, documentary, which is mucking up the language.
Everybody.
Everybody's pissed about that. But from what I've seen about libertarians, it's predominantly the ideology of the white upper middle class, right? It exists almost exclusively in North America, and then you might have some libertarian movements in parts of Europe or, you know, I mean, I got into it in Twitter with some libertarians from, like, Latin America, but it's like eight dudes. It's like eight dudes. And whenever you hear about libertarianism in Latin America, it's always somebody from the United States trying to impose something down there. It's never organic. It's never grassroots. Like, you're never going to see, like, in Africa, people organizing among libertarian ideology. So, I mean, it cracks me up. But, yes, in their heads, they see themselves as, like, these revolutionaries, you know, revolting against this. It's weird to me because they think they're revolting against government, but ultimately they want to replace government with big business. So you want to replace one authority with another, and that's libertarianism in a nutshell.
It was those farmers that were wondering why was they giving their money to a monarchy 3,000 miles away that never been to America. And, I mean, and bear in mind, we are cognizant of the fact that we are on stolen land. While we're talking about people stolen land. The people who actually stole it, by the way.
Yeah.
But we're talking about farmers out there, poor farmers just basically tilling the land, wondering why is it we're giving our taxes, all of our money to this king and to this kingdom that doesn't have anything to do with us.
Yeah.
And then Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense and really started ginning up the works, really started getting people interested in the idea of what we can be autonomous. And then the libertarians, such as Washington, Hamilton, Franklin, for what it's worth. Franklin was one of the better ones. So was Adams, and so on. You know, Madison. You know, they're the ones that turned it into what it was. As a matter of fact, Madison came up with the Federalist Papers, and holy shit.
I do want to tell people that we are organizing, and anybody who wants to be part of organizing against AMRAAM, we have a Facebook group, Oppose White Supremacists at Montgomery Bell State Park. If you can find that on Facebook, there's some screening, so we may reach out to you for more information before we let you in. But we are trying to turn out a huge group of people who want to oppose them using the park.
All right, we're going to play you guys a lot of old songs because we don't have a lot more than that. So we're going to dig one up here that started back in 1985. a little classic tale of good versus evil. This one's called Legions of Death.
Going to check something as you're talking, but I want to find out. Operation Save America used to be called Operation Rescue, and that was founded by Randall Terry. And then Randall Terry left and broke off from the group, and then Tucci, I think his name was, he had he had taken over. He was there for a little bit. Then a guy named Flip Benham, who was a load of laughs. I mean, I saw him, Gratian, when I was there as a reporter. And he didn't like my gear because I walked up to him while he was doing his thing, wearing I was wearing this beautiful pink button that said I'm pro-choice and I shoot back, and he hated that. He hated that. But hey, to that group, I think there was issues concerning how violent they were back in the day. We'll bring it up in another show. I wanted to see whether or not I want to be sure that Operation Rescue was associated with tersely associated with some of the clinic bombings that happened back in the day. I got an SPLC article.
One of the things reading, Daryl, is they prayed for the abortion clinic terrorists.
Okay.
They had at least that association, that they were having prayer for the clinic bombers.
We'll pray for Antifa.
they need your prayers, evidently. I got to say that the counter demonstration was extraordinarily effective, not only in bringing some decent music to the scene, but their presence just seemed to have derailed the agenda. Because the speakers kept trying to pray over the what they imagine is Antifa. They had many, many members surrounding them, you know, imposing the Holy Spirit upon them. You can tell that the agenda did not include all that, but they felt compelled, speaker after speaker, call out the anti-fascist demonstrators. All the tropes you hear about how sad they are and how we need to pray for them because they don't know better. One speaker said they don't know better. Another speaker said they absolutely do know what they're doing because they live in their parents' basements and are watching pornography all night and playing video games, presumably simultaneously, which, you know, hey, that's a beat.
I have to ask, Will, really quick. I mean, I'm looking at this speakers list of assorted white bearded men, and, like, were there any? What was the female presence on the side of, you know, Operation Save America? You said that there were some girls, like children, but I see a bunch of white guys, presumably knowing what's best for everybody, leading an anti-choice demonstration. I mean, can you talk about the makeup of the protesters versus the counter-protesters?
Well, I can say that as far as Operation Save America, it was actually very diverse as far as gender is concerned.
Okay.
There were a lot of families there, but there was a tremendous incongruity between who was there versus who was speaking, right? Because in the sort of Christian nationalist worldview, women are required, depending on your particular sect, to shut up and obey their husbands. So there were a lot of women and children there. They had a lot of the children holding those real large colors, you know, photographs of allegedly aborted fetuses and all this sort of thing.
Thanks for listening. Please make a small donation to these content creators. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G., Radio Free Kansas.